I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome back to Radio Times. Stieg Larsson was a struggling journalist who was investigating fascism and the extreme right wing in Sweden when he wrote the Millennium Trilogy. He sadly died of a heart attack before he could enjoy its success. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest have sold more than 65 million copies. Larsson's longtime partner, Eva Gabrielsson, has written a memoir about their life together, the inspiration for these novels, and her battles with the Larsson family. The book is titled There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me, written with Marie-Françoise Colombani. Eva Gabrielsson joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's an architect, clearly an author, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Let me begin with the title of your book, which I really like very much. There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me. Where did that title come from?
The original title was Millennium Stieg and Me, but this was the American publisher's idea. It's a quote from Stieg's goodbye letter to me he wrote in 1977. Which has that sentence, there are things I want you to know. And I thought, this is great. I should have thought of that myself.
But are you surprised that there's so many things that people want to know about Stieg Larsson and you?
Yeah, it's a bit of a surprise. I start to understand why movie stars and well-known authors try to get away from the public eye, because there's not that much interesting, really, I think.
Really? Yeah. I mean, would you say you're a private person now, kind of thrust in the, or thrusting yourself in the public eye?
Absolutely. And Stieg, too. He would have felt the same.
So. Maybe an unfair question, but, you know, he did die, sadly, before these books were published. And it's just breathtaking to think how many have been bought and read. Is there any way to know how he would have enjoyed, or whether he would have enjoyed his success?
I don't think he would have changed as a person. He would still be sort of gentle and kind, and not really bothering about luxury articles or bothering about being a celebrity and stuff like that. But I'm sure of that, because we planned our life ahead together, what we would do, and we would write more, write political stuff and other stuff, and work together again. So we were sort of planning not to retire, so to say, on some luxury island, but to have these as means to do what we dreamt of doing.
And for you, are you surprised that these books have found such a huge readership?
Yes, it's a huge surprise.
What do you think it says? I mean, how do you understand this curiosity, enthusiasm for these books? Hmm.
I'm a bit torn there. On the one hand, it's great that people love the characters. It's great that they like the theme of the books, which is fighting for justice against corruption and abuse of power, and the main thing, discrimination and violence against women. That's great. But it's also very scary that we have a world now, because the book is sold in so many countries, that people obviously recognize these misgivings in their own lives. So I start to think about what kind of world do we have nowadays.
That this is a more common theme. In fact, the first book begins, 18% of women in Sweden have at one time been threatened by a man.
Yeah, and this is an official report. So it's based on statistics and good research and so on. So it's an official report, yeah.
And Stieg Larsson wanted to call that first book Men Who Hate Women.
Mm. Well, it is everywhere except in the English-speaking world.
In the English-speaking world, we got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah, this children's books title.
Oh, is that how you see them?
Yeah.
As opposed, I mean, a strong title like Men Who Hate Women. I mean, it doesn't get more sort of in your face than that.
That is the theme for the three books, and that's why Stieg fought to keep it, and he managed to keep it in Sweden and in Europe, but after he was dead, the English rights were sold, and obviously then they were allowed to change the title, so...
You write about the fact that you met him. This was, what, 1969?
72.
Oh, 72, sorry. At a protest rally against the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Where were you? What was the rally?
Well, there was this huge anti-war movement in Sweden at the time. There were hundreds of thousands of young kids joining up for this. And so we were just doing what quite a lot of people were doing. And this was just one of the ordinary mm-hmm. meetings, talking about the latest developments and debating what was going on and what was to be done and so on. That's how we met.
Right.
And Stig was already active, of course. He was very quick to pick up on issues that needed to be solved. So he had been active for a year or two, something like that. So he was sort of the host there and welcomed people. And that's how he was greeting me and my little sister when we came.
And did you say to yourself, cute guy?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, so that's how we met.
Yeah. But I got the feeling the way you wrote about your relationship and as you were falling in love, that you argued a lot about politics. I mean, that either arguing about or discussing politics, yeah. That was so central to your relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. That was also typical for the times among quite a lot of young people at that age and at that time. So we were sort of part of what everyone else was doing, but I think that we were differed as well from quite a lot of people because we were rather firmly rooted in some kind of reality. We weren't dreamers, and we couldn't accept dictatorial tendencies or orders from above, go out and do and don't ask questions and things like that. So we were a bit weren't not that maybe easy to handle.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Now, he was, at the time, as you describe, he was a Maoist and you were a Trotskyite,
yeah.
Right?
Huge difference.
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, because the Trotskyite movement, they stood for multi-party systems. They stood for a democracy. They understood that things were political ideas represent different segments of society, and you can't cut away some people and say they shouldn't have any say. There's always some legal claims to what they do. There's some justifications for it. But the Maoists were the opposite. There was some chairman or the other who had all the answers, and everyone was to fall in line. And I don't know how Stig ended up there. He must have had. I think he had friends who were right. who were in that group. But I got
sounds
him.
Like you don't like it. That. You don't follow orders or
no. Or and he actually didn't. So he woke up after a year or so and left.
So was it love at first sight or was it love over time?
It was love over time.
As you got to know each other.
Yeah, yeah. Love over time. Yeah.
And he was a journalist at the time, I guess, or became a journalist. In fact, wrote for a British magazine called Searchlight, and then started his own, I guess, magazine in Sweden called Expo.
Yeah.
And the idea was to investigate some of these extreme, right-wing organizations, people in Sweden.
Yeah, they were starting to grow. They were... he started to work with a British magazine in 83 because that was the only magazine that really tried to follow these groups and these politics, how they developed, how they kind of contacts they had, what kind of actions they did and what they were aiming at. And then during the 80s and the beginning of the 1990s in Scandinavia, these groups started to grow and emerge and actually commit quite a lot of brutal crimes. So there was a need for a Swedish version of Searchlight, and that came in 1995 with Expo. And there were threats from day one.
Threats to you and Stig Larsson and people that were working on
Expo? Oh, we had threats hanging over us since the late 1980s, but Expo, everyone at Expo, including the printer and the ones who sold the paper, got threats and smashed. And I know the one printer didn't dare to continue printing.
Because he was so scared?
Yeah.
And these were, what, death threats? I know bullets sometimes arriving in the mail, yeah. People that would be
death
watching.
Threats. Yeah.
Were you scared at the time, just thinking about this world that you were living
not,
in?
Not scared, really, but worried. You got a feeling for what their historical historical companions were doing in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. But this was on a larger scale. You got a feel for it.
The kind of fascism,
and you knew they meant business. It wasn't idle threats. They really meant to do something, and they did kill people. They did execute police officers. They did beat up immigrants.
You know, I think some people think of Sweden as this kind of socialist paradise. I mean, this idea where, you know, the social safety net takes care of people, and there isn't this great disparity between rich and poor, and what this magazine was doing, and also what the Millennium Trilogy does, which is to show a really dark side, the underbelly of Sweden.
Well, rather the reality as it is. I don't know why we are called a socialist state. I mean, the state owns very little of the infrastructure and the business. We have always been a country with a high focus on private business and trade. One of our main trading partners has always been the United States since way back.
Yeah, we buy a lot
so
of
we,
stuff.
So we love free trade, and so it's you can't say that we're really state-owned country like that. But we do have a great social security system that is slowly crumbling now as well, due to the world crisis and so on. But we still have the institutions, you know. Even if they are cut down, and even if, you know, figures, the sums you can get are cut down, we still have the institutions in place, and we have the laws in place, and we have the regulations in place. So I think we can take cutbacks because we know it's temporary. Mm.
And you're an architect.
Yeah.
Interested in what kinds of architecture, what kinds of design?
Mainly housing, actually. I think it's one of the most difficult things to design at a good price and at comfort for people, and also make the house sustainable, so you don't have to pay for repairs for decades because it wasn't built right from the beginning. So That's a challenge for any architect.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Eva Gabrielsson. She is an architect and an author was longtime partner with Stieg Larsson, and has written a book called There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me. We will carry on our conversation after this very short break. Any questions or comments you might have, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Its magical images have delighted generations. In a concert for families, Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in scenes from Disney's Fantasia, accompanied by the iconic film and original animated scenes on a giant screen. Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Waltzing Flowers, and more. It's all part of the Stokowski Celebration. Tickets online or 215-893-1999. Saturday, June 23rd at the Academy of Music, Disney's Fantasia in concert.
The Culinary Arts Institute of Montgomery County Community College supports WHYY. Whether looking to launch a career as an executive chef or just looking to get a better handle in your home kitchen, the Culinary Arts Institute has classes to serve a full range of needs and interests. The school's certified faculty prepare students with a foundation in the classics while educating them on the latest modern trends. Details at mc3.edu/culinaryarts. The Culinary Arts Institute of Montgomery County Community College. Education at the knife's edge.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents the first ordained North American Reform, Reconstructionist, and Conservative rabbis, and first open Orthodox rabbi on Monday, June 4th at 6:30 p.m. Rabbi Sally Presand, Sandy Eisenberg Sasso, Amy Eilberg, and Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz, in conversation with historian Pam Nadel, will share their unique experiences as firsts in their field and how and why they decided to become Jewish spiritual leaders. 215-923-3811 or nmajh.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy, including the titles, the American titles, I should say, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, has been a bestseller, selling more than 65 million copies, turned into movies. And sadly, Stieg Larsson didn't live long enough to enjoy the success of his books. His longtime companion, Eva Gabrielsson, is with us. She's written a book, her own book, called These Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me. It's about their life together, the inspiration for these novels, and her battles with Larsson's family over literary rights to the trilogy. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You write that you were on vacation with Stieg Larsson, and he was kind of, you were working on your own book, and he was kind of bored. And you kind of told him to sit down and get himself busy with something.
Well, I didn't want him to wander around and disturb me, so I had to ask him, don't you have anything to do to write about?
Was he just wandering around and just...
Literally, yeah. It was highly...
Interrupting you?
Extremely. So I had to get him off off somewhere. And then he thought about this little text he had written in 1997 about this old man who receives flowers each year. And I thought that was a good idea. Who is that man? Why is he receiving flowers? And Stieg said, I have no idea. Huh. Well, why don't you figure that out or something like that? So that's how Millennium started.
Wow.
And it was very typical of Stieg to write a scene that was just an interesting scene, and he didn't know what it was about himself.
And wrote to, I guess, figure it out.
Yeah.
And so once he began to think about this particular scene, the man receiving these framed flowers, that was the beginning of this trilogy.
Exactly.
And was he kind of a fast and furious writer once he got going?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Extremely fast. You could say he almost wrote the way he talked. He was a great storyteller. He could tell stories for hours and hours and hours. And he was fast. So he actually just wrote down what he would normally, how he would normally tell a story to large part. I guess that's why the dialogue, at least in the Swedish version, is quite, it's flowing. It's got a nice flow.
You write in this book that he is maybe more like Lisbeth Salander than he is like the journalist in the novels.
Well, that's my impression. Yeah.
How do you mean that?
There's some core value in Lisbeth Salander to fight for your rights and to fend for yourself and to fight for your friends and never give up. And this stubbornness is very much like Stieg. He shares with Mikael Blomqvist this idea of journalism as an important tool to understand society and to provide people with reliable information to be able to make judgments, especially in elections and so on. And that's why you need to invest in journalism and media, and you have to be very careful with research and check your sources and protect your sources and so on. So that's what he shares with he's sort of the professional Stieg is you can find in Mikael Blomqvist, but this stubbornness, this fighting spirit, that's what you find in Lisbeth
Salander. That's interesting. And he had a good, I mean, she has a photographic memory, and she's a total whiz when it comes to computers. He had a very good memory, as you write about him.
Yeah, but not photographic. And he was no computer whiz either.
You
so
know
maybe she's in a way was the ideal.
You're right. Why wouldn't that be? Wouldn't that be great? She, though, as you write, comes from an incident that he observed as a younger man, or maybe even a student, where he saw a young woman being gang raped, and he stood by or was a bystander.
Yeah, he was a bystander. I don't think that was the origin of Lisbeth Salander, though, but I guess he was surprised, because these were people he knew, guys he knew. I think they were a bit older than him as well. And he was just surprised, because he thought he knew them, and then suddenly you see that, Christ, I had no idea what they would do. And they were older than him, and there were more of them than him, so he tried to stop them, but he couldn't. Mm. And this was something that tormented him all his life, I'd say. We'd been together for 10 years. And that was the first... just after 10 years, he was able to talk to me about it. And he was in pain.
Because of, obviously, the violence that was perpetrated on this woman and the fact that he was not able to stop
Yeah, that. Both of it. I think he could identify with being an underdog.
And thinking about this character, Lisbeth Salander, and she has this photographic memory. She has this goth, and she's a loner. She loves fast food. I think he did as well. And she has this pretty horrific childhood as well. Mm. People also, though, have connected with her. I mean, they feel so strongly about her. Do you understand that connection? Why people are so taken with her, so intrigued by her?
I didn't at first. I mean, I was. I really liked her. She's a complex, but she's a good guy. But she does things maybe not the way that are legally right and so on. But I thought that she would be too much for a general audience.
They wouldn't believe that someone like this existed.
No, I was afraid that they would. Dislike the way she takes the laws in her own hands, and she's quite egoistic as well.
Yeah.
And she wants her way all the time, and she's not just a black and white person. There's a lot of gray in her, but a lot of black as well. So she's difficult.
You also make a reference to Pippi Longstockings.
Mm.
How does that work? With Lisbeth Salander.
She's quite like Lisbeth Salander. I mean, she has a lot of money, which Lisbeth Salander gets in the end. She's stubborn. She knows what she wants. She helps out people who need help. She beats up bad guys. So there are many, many similarities. Mm. And maybe Lisbeth Salander is what Pippi Longstockings would have been when she had been grown up.
Oh, interesting. Did he run pages by you? Did you edit in that way or give him reactions as he was writing?
Yeah, I gave him reactions all the time. I commented on what I read and discussed things and so on. But he was... Normally, I could take his texts and just take things out and go and do research and add new things. These were the more professional texts, the political texts, mm-hmm. and so on. But this was prose, and this was part of a creative process. So there are lots of things that I didn't do deliberately because he was in some kind of separate world that I had to be very, very gentle with. So most of all, I encouraged and I agreed and I did agree because there were so many, I recognized so much from our life and I recognized people who were wandering around the book who we knew and I recognized events that had taken place and so on. So there wasn't really much for me to object.
Yeah,
this is right. Yeah, this is what it was and so on. So.
Did you see yourself in that book?
I guess I'm here and there.
Scattered in among the characters or incidents, things like that.
Yeah.
I've interviewed a number of journalists who have become novelists or have written fiction, and almost all of them say they've, not to take away from the journalism they were doing, but they felt that there was, if not greater truth in their fiction, they felt like they were able to maybe get closer to the truth that they were looking for in writing fiction. Does that make some sense to
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. I think that's why people write fiction as well, because they can say things that they maybe don't have the evidence for, or the three sources, or the hard statistics for, but you still know it's the truth.
Even if you can't sort of verify it in the way you have to verify it as a journalist, you know in your heart that it's true.
Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And talking today on Radio Times with Eva Gabrielsen, and she has written a book called There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson. She's an architect and author. She has been politically active for much of her life and was Stieg Larsson's longtime partner. And she has written a book about the writing of the Millennium Trilogy, some of the what it was like in Sweden as Stieg Larsson was investigating fascism and right-wing extremists. And the book is also about the battles that she has had with Stieg Larsson's family over these books. And the books are here in the U.S. known as The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Did Stieg Larsson think this trilogy is going to be a hit? Did he have any sense of that, or did he even think that way?
Yes, a normal hit. A normal hit which for crime novels, Swedish crime novels, and that means they would sell well in Scandinavia and in Germany and in Holland. That's it. But that would be a hit.
But that would be a hit as well. Yeah. And he did love fast food, as you say, like Lisbeth Salander. Mm. He was, 50 years old when he died?
Yeah, just turned 50.
Yeah, and died of a heart attack.
Yeah.
Had he had heart problems?
No.
And he was going up some stairs and got out of breath?
Seven flights, yeah.
Wow. Was he out of shape?
He was out of shape, definitely. So I think this must have been something that had built up for years. It's not something that just hits you in the head like that. But he never did any medical checkups. Mm-hmm. He should have.
Did he smoke? Was he a smoker?
Yeah.
Which must have been a shock to find out that he had died.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't even there. I was away at work, 3 hours away by train. So I just got a phone call one day, after saying goodbye to him the night before, and he was fine then. Just got a phone call that he had collapsed and that I had to get back to Stockholm immediately. Mm. And when I arrived, he was dead. Mm. He had died almost on the minute when I set foot on the train. That was a bit unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. You talk about at his funeral, you read a letter that he wrote to you. Mm.
Well, since he was a public figure, there had to be some kind of memorial meeting with the speakers that would be semi-public for invited guests, whereas the funeral ceremony would have to be a closed and secret one. So we had to involve the Swedish security police in the funeral ceremony to make sure that there wouldn't be any right-wingers there.
Oh.
Enjoying themselves, but I selected the speakers, and there were 18 of them, and I had to select myself, and I had no idea what to say because I had no words for what I was experiencing or where I was at the world or how I would describe Stieg or what I would do. So I thought about this letter because I was going to say some kind of goodbye.
Yeah. Which you hadn't had a chance to do, right?
Yeah, and so I thought that, he wrote me a letter in 1977 when he left for Africa and thought he might not come back alive, and I thought I would try to find that letter.
So that's a nice letter.
That's what I read.
Yeah, it must have been hard, though.
Yeah.
A difficult time.
A difficult time, yeah.
And when these books were published, did that kind of stir up these extreme groups in Sweden? I mean, yes, it's fiction, but nonetheless, it's about all this intrigue and, powerful people and violence and, secrets.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the books didn't stir up any more activity on their part. I mean, they move by other politics and lack of politics, rather. There's always a vacuum, then they can step in. So they would have grown anyway. But they were so happy that Stig was dead.
How do you know that?
Blogs.
Oh, blogs, of course. Mm. So they felt like this person who had been investigating them was...
Finally.
Was not around anymore. Yeah. But Expo exists.
Yeah. They managed to pull themselves together and they are doing fine. That's also a relief because one of my greatest worries was that they would simply collapse when Stig died and wouldn't be able to pull themselves together afterwards. And that would have been horrible because it's... Well, almost 10 years work that would have gone down the drain.
Yeah.
They are doing really, really fine.
And doing the same kind of work, kind of investigative work.
And they're doing the good work, yeah.
You write about, and this gets, of course, complicated with the battles that you've had with Stig Larsson's family, but you write about just how angry you were and how hurt you were. And even felt that there were people that, if not, didn't exactly contribute to his death, but in a sense, maybe didn't help him the way they could have. And you go through a kind of a ritual to cleanse all these feelings that you had.
Yeah.
An interesting Norse pagan ritual.
Yeah. Old Viking thing. Yeah, it's a curse.
A curse to be in what way?
Well, it's a poem, but it's also a curse. Yeah. You call on the old Viking gods to punish the ones who done wrong and continue punishing them until they change their ways.
Wow.
So it's quite rough. And you're supposed to sacrifice a horse, and that was sort of logistic practical problem, but I solved it by symbolically sacrificing a clay horse.
Broke it in half, right?
I just threw it into the water where the Vikings used to sail, and it was a great relief because this was 2 months after Stig died and 1 month after I had to try to hold that speech at the memorial meeting, and 2 months after I still didn't have any words, so I needed a shape and I needed something that would guide me in how to express what I felt.
Mm-hmm. And were you alone and sort of shouting at the heavens, so to
speak? No, there were other people there who I would consider to be close to Stig and me, who had the same feeling of being totally shattered and confused and so on. So this curse was for them as well, because they'd seen how Stig had worked and burnt out because of others were not doing their job or taking advantage of him and so on.
So did the curse work? Or did you feel better after?
We felt extremely relieved, all of us, but apart from that, I actually think it works.
Oh, you do?
People have died. People have lost their jobs.
I am going to pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Eva Gabrielsen today on Radio Time. She was a longtime partner with Stig Larsson, and she's written a book called There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stig Larsson and Me. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. 65 million people have read the Millennium Trilogy. I'm sure you have a question. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Savoy Company presents Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado at the DuPont Theater and Longwood Gardens. Under the stage direction of Ted Christopher and musical direction of Todd Florin, this mystical tale of wit is a musical delight. DuPont Theater performances on June 1st and 2nd and at Longwood Gardens on June 29th and 30th. More information and tickets online at savoy.org or at 215-735-7161.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. At Fox Chase, molecular medicine helps improve diagnostics for cancer patients. Using the genetic analysis of tumor cells, doctors readily identify the best use of existing cancer drugs and design more effective clinical trials. As DNA sequencing becomes more prevalent in cancer care, Fox Chase is committed to discovering how these methods can best help patients and lead to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents the Philadelphia Orchestra live in concert Wednesday, June 27th. It's Beethoven's Ninth Symphony featuring the Philadelphia singers and soloists from the Academy of Vocal Arts. Then on Friday, June 29th, it's the Mann Summer Tradition with the orchestra, the All Tchaikovsky Spectacular with fireworks. Tickets for the Philadelphia Orchestra live in concert at the Mann are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Eva Gabrielsen, longtime partner of Stieg Larsson. Stieg Larsson, the author of the Millennium Trilogy. He was also a journalist in Sweden investigating right-wing extremist groups, wrote for a magazine that he started there called Expo. And some of those themes have shown up in the books that he wrote, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Okay, so before the break, you said you in a sense, went through this ritual and cursed the people that you felt had hurt you and hurt Stieg Larsson, and in some cases feel that it worked? People paid for what they had done?
Yeah, and that was kind of scary.
Yeah.
I mean,
do you think it's because you said it?
No, I think they had it coming anyway, but You do think about it,
right.
Yeah.
Can you identify with Lisbeth Salander wanting, if not revenge, some kind of justice?
I think that's a better way of putting it, wanting justice. Because that is what she's doing. I guess that was what my curse was up to as well.
Well, and you write about, and it was in the press, about your fights with Stieg Larsson's family over the literary rights of the trilogy. And I guess part of the problem was that you two were not married, right?
No, and if you're not married, you have no legal rights in Sweden. And it's that bad, we can't even go to court. The law doesn't provide for us to let a court decide if it's reasonable or not after being together 10 or 15 or 20, and in our case, more than 30 years.
Right. And why didn't you marry?
Because of the threats. We needed Stieg to stay unmarried in the public records so that the extreme right wings wouldn't get to him, because they would find his address, and they did have it in their lists. There were continuous house searches among people who had threatened or killed people, and Stieg's name was always on these lists of names that kept increasing from a few hundred to 1,000 to the latest was in 1999 when the list was 2,000 names. Mm. And they had his address there. But they still couldn't find him because his name wasn't on the door, and they couldn't track him through his phone bills because the phone was in my name and so on. So I was a surprise to them when I appeared after Stieg's death, because they were always trying to link him up with one man or the other. They thought he was gay.
Oh, interesting. Mm. Oh, and why did they think that? That's how they think?
Because he wasn't married.
Oh, I see. Mm. I see.
Because I was nowhere to be seen.
What was his relationship with his family and your relationship with his family? When he was alive?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that we had the same way of being and with his biological family. You sort of adopt your partner's relationships, and you can't be best friends with someone they are trying to pull away from or being distant to, and so on. So it was pretty much the same. That's the surprising part. Even though you're not on bad terms and you're not on good terms, you're just on some kind of social graces terms. To still see that they didn't, after Stieg died, they didn't respect his choice to leave the north and move to Stockholm with me and to build up a new life with me, and they couldn't accept his choices.
The family offered you some money, but it sounds like what you want, and I guess still want, are the literary rights.
Yeah.
More than the money?
Yeah.
Because...
But they didn't offer me anything at all until after five years after Stieg died. Mm-hmm. And that was because Hollywood wouldn't sign the film contracts unless something was settled with me. Mm. And then they broke off the talks after a few months anyway, so...
And where does that stand today?
It stands there. They broke off the talks, and my lawyer says that we have no reason to go back to them. They broke it off, so I don't know. It's some legal formality on how to run things. I don't get it.
I mean, do you have legal standing on this issue at all?
No.
No. So it's sort of their, what, the goodness of their heart, if they're willing to?
Yeah, and that seems to be sadly lacking, both the goodness and the heart. Mm. Which is a surprise. You think you know people, even if you, or you know about them, you don't expect things like that to happen. But it happens all the time. So I actually wrote a book about other people in my situation a year before my own book about me and Millennium, Stig and me and Millennium came out. And I found cases that were even more horrifying than my own, just in an effort to try to change the law. And I haven't succeeded yet, but I'm not alone in this.
And why do you want literary rights? Why is that important to you?
Well, it was important to be able to keep... It's an obligation under the law, and an immaterial rights law, to secure and care for the author's intentions. Mm-hmm. And that is not being done at all with all these changes that are allowed, with all these ways of marketing the books that are totally against the theme of justice for women and not exploiting women. I mean, if you have an advertising campaign saying, which girl do you want to take home for Christmas? This is not in line with what the books are saying. So there are lots of things that you should do when you get this obligation and this trust to care for, which isn't done. And that is what I wanted to do, and that is what I offered the family. Because I thought they were mistaken somehow. So this was an offer I gave to them a year after Stig died and didn't want it.
And can I assume that you have seen the Swedish version and the David Fincher version, or yes or no?
I haven't seen the David Fincher one, but I've seen the Swedish ones.
And what did you make of that? Did you think that was a fairly good representation of the story, the novels?
Well, fairly good. I think you could have. Some of the actors could have done better. I think you could have added things to the script and taken other things away to sort of cut it down to a better feminist theme.
Huh.
I think you should have done that. But the one who really carries it all is the one who plays Lisbeth Salander, Noomi Rapace. She really understood the books, and she fought for her character, and she refused to read substantial parts of the original manuscript film script because it was out of character.
Oh, that's interesting.
So she was managing the literary legacy and in her own way, and I was really happy to hear that from someone who worked with the film crew.
And this in the book and in that particular version, movie version, the tattoo covers her whole back. I mean, it really is. It is very much a part of what you see about her when you see her back. And I know you have complained that tattoo has gotten shrunken over time.
Well, not. It has been shrunken in the English editions. So what she has is something that's rather small and cute on her shoulder. Nice. But it's this huge monster that's there in red, black, and green. As a memory of her trauma and also as a way of showing people that even if I turn your back to you, look at my inner self, beware. she's not to be taken for granted, and she is there to frighten you if you do her wrong.
At the end of your book, you worry about the branding of Stieg Larsson and the Millennium Trilogy. You write, I do not want his name to be an industry or a brand. The way things are going, what's to stop me from one day seeing his name on a bottle of beer, a packet of coffee, or a car? I mean, do you really think that would happen, the Stieg Larsson, you know, microbrewery?
Well, the family sold the merchandising rights to Hollywood, so what do you know?
Mm.
That was the last thing they had to sell.
You think they're in it for the money? Is that
sure?
You have an, Stieg Larsson's laptop.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that in such an accusatory way. No. But there is, or perhaps was, a fourth novel in this trilogy that he was writing?
It's a fragment of a novel. It's about 200 pages, and I write about it in my book as well, because people ask about it.
Of course.
Don't think it's in sequence and so on. Sequence, I think it's probably not hanging together. It's like Millennium started with interesting scenes and texts, and then some pages might be... I haven't read it, you know, I just know what it was about.
Oh, you haven't read it?
No, I didn't have the time to do it. I was working so hard. And
oh, really?
So we just talked about it when I came home for the extended weekends from my work and so on. So, but I don't think it should be published. It would just be used up. It would be, you know, it's... It would also do the author wrong, I think, when there are three completed works by his hands, and the rest would just be ghostwriting or taken advantage of and so on. And I don't really see that this is in line with treating any artist with respect.
Having worked with him on the other books, I mean, do you feel any sense that you could complete this book?
That is what I offered the family at first, but then to do that I would need to get the literary rights as well, and they refused. So
there it stands.
There it stands.
Let me get looks like Sonia from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Sonia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi.
Hey,
Eva.
Hey.
I'm from Sweden. My question is, I did read the whole trilogy in Swedish. I happened to be in Sweden in 2007 for a funeral, and I asked a friend what's good to read, and she said, oh, these Larsson books are really good right now. So I picked them up. I picked up the first one, actually, and read it. And then I read the rest, the whole trilogy. My question is, do you like the translations? I haven't read them in English, and I would just like to know how you feel about the translation if you've read it. And I'll take my answer off the air because my signal is very bad on my phone.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Time, Sonia. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I've just looked at the English translation here and there, and it's sort of... what do you say? It's taken the edge of the book. It's the dialogue is changed into being less provocative and so on. And this dragon, as we said, is become a very, very small little cute thing on a small girl's shoulder instead of this huge terrifying beast on a very angry young lady's back. So there's a lot of changes done. But I haven't had the time to go through them. Others have gone through them, and there's an anthology published in America called something The Tattooed Girl or something, where a friend of ours, John Henry Holmberg, went through at least the first book and looked at the translation. So,
and came to the same kind of conclusion you did, which has been watered down or cleaned up a little bit.
Yeah.
But as you say, even the titles have a kind of girlishness to them.
Yeah.
Sonia, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You write that after these books were published, you really went through, and I'm quoting here, a wonderful period began. And it sounds like with his work and your work, there were times where you were either apart a lot or just didn't have time to be together. Mm. But this sounded like a nice period.
It was
cooking together.
Yeah, it was a great period, especially this to be able to plan ahead without worrying where the next rent would come from, even if it was a year off, you know. He wasn't well paid at Expo, and my work was due to stop as well after a certain period. So finally we could focus on planning on what we really wanted to do and how we really wanted to live and what we really wanted to accomplish. So we sat there and designed a small writer's cottage as well during that summer.
Mm. Sounds kind of romantic.
Sending the sketches back and forth and agreeing on it, and I placed the order at a construction company. I think 10 days before Stieg died.
Oh dear!
And I had to sort of cancel it.
Yeah, so it never got built.
No.
He also said he was going to establish some kind of a company where you would be co-founders, and you know it would be a source of income. Did that ever happen, or?
No, that company never happened. I got the impression that a Swedish publisher was going to help him with the administration, the papers on the paperwork, and we never received the advance either from the Swedish publisher because there was no company in where to place this money. So we never saw the advance at all. And I thought the company was in place when Stieg died, and after 2 months, the Swedish publisher said that no, there's no company. And then I knew I wouldn't inherit, and I would have to go into negotiations with the family.
We're almost out of time here, but do you feel like you have been wronged?
Absolutely, and most of all, Stieg has been wronged because this whole inheritance. Thing is also a way of getting back at him.
Mm. Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us today in Radio Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Eva Gabrielsen has been our guest. Her book is There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me. She's a writer, clearly, and an architect as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, podcasts. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow. Wayne, thank you so much for joining us.